Welcome to the Pac-Man Podcast. Here you will find Dr. Cindy Elliser and Kat McKeever, researchers at Pacific Mammal Research, talking all about marine mammals. We will have a variety of ways to share information with you through discussing research articles and news stories, interviews with other researchers, and more. Join us to learn more about marine mammals and have some fun.
Welcome to the Pac-Man Podcast. I'm Cindy.
And I'm Kat.
And we're very excited for this episode because this is our first requested journal review or requested topic at all.
Yay!
Yay! We had one of our Instagram followers who corresponds with us actually quite a bit. They wanted us to do this particular journal review if we were taking requests. And we said, yes, we are. Thank you so much. And this was an interesting one that just recently came out in the last, it was in October, so last month. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So this is the ancestry testing of Old Tom, a killer whale central to mutualistic interactions with human whalers. And this is in the Journal of Heredity and by Reeves et al. There's quite a few. Oh, Karen Stockton on there too. I didn't see that. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about this in the paper, but it really is interesting because it is the scientific publication that is incorporating indigenous and traditional knowledge and really is a huge part of describing what was happening with this whale and everything. So it's a great example of how we can learn from multiple ways of knowing and putting those all together to get a better story, especially historically. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I mean, I will say too, like just before we kind of as part of that preface, we do have quite a few previous episodes where we talk about things like community scientists and incorporating community members or the Whale Watch community or Indigenous peoples into scientific studies. So we definitely do have some previous podcasts where we talk about the importance of including, moving beyond just the academic scientific research field to inform a lot of our scientific research. So definitely go check out some of those previous episodes as well if you are interested in learning more about how incorporating additional knowledge can be really, really powerful when it comes to scientific research.
Mm-hmm. And especially in this context of historical, because those ones you're talking about are more current, right? We're using community scientists and other ways, but this is looking back. And if we're only looking back within the narrow line of history that, white people or Europeans or whatever context you're looking at, you're not looking beyond when they came to that land. There's been the indigenous people have been there for time immemorial, right? So negating that information, you're not getting the whole story, right?
It's exactly
a really important part. So this is an interesting story because this killer whale, or these killer whales, were from Eden, New South Wales, which is the eastern coast of Australia, in this little bay. And so also the purpose with the indigenous part, there are quite a few indigenous names here, and sometimes they use the indigenous name of the place and then the current name that is more well known. We will try our best to correctly say the indigenous words, but we couldn't find really good examples of how to say the words. So we do apologize if we get any of them incorrectly in how we say them, but we are trying our best. And we'll default to the more current name just because I don't want to say it incorrectly.
Yeah.
These whales have been known for at least 100 years, in the 1800s to the early 1900s, to cooperate with whalers to basically corral a baleen whale and share the whale between the two. So this is a pretty, well documented, at least for those 100 years. And this is where bringing that indigenous knowledge and understanding how long this had actually been going on before European colonization of the areas occurred is really important. And I'm going to start with, there is a foreword by Stephen Holmes, who is Thaua is the indigenous peoples that are in this area. So he did a foreword before the start of the paper. My name is Stephen Holmes, a Thaua traditional custodian, and this history is part of my people's legacy. We consider Biawas, or killer whales, to be our brothers. Our dreamtime stories, which connect us to the Biawas, is that when a Thawa member dies, they are reincarnated as a Biawa. The Biawas remain part of the Thawa even after passing. The Biawas would help the men by herding the other whales in the Bay of Turimbalerer, or Twofold Bay, for the whalers to kill. Buddingbro, who is a grand, I think it's a grandfather or great-grandfather of this family. Buddingbro, as his ancestors and the other aboriginals, would give the Biawas the tongue of the dead whale. This was soon known as the Law of the Tongue. My people had a long-lasting friendship with the Biawa in Eden, especially Old Tom. My Nan, Catherine Holmes, Nee Rierly, told us about her great-grandfather, Buddingbro, who, all along with other Thawa, would swim with Old Tom, holding on to his dorsal fin. My ancestors were never hurt or injured. She said that Buddingbro's father, a blind man, would walk along the beach, singing to the Biawas. The Biawas would follow him along the beach, communicating back and forth with him. It was a strong friendship between these Biawas and my people. For the Thawa, this was a special time to be alive, a part of our history that was passed on from generation to generation. I hope one day I am able to reconnect with Biawas. So I think that's a good just kind of preface to how long the story is, and we're only telling a small part of it in going over this journal. But the question that this paper is asking about is basically, who were these whales, right? Were they part of, who are they more related to in the current killer whales that are out there right now? And are there any descendants, right? So where genetically do they fit in the evolution of killer whales in this area and honestly around the world, as we're going to find out?
And part of the reason why that's so important to know is because these whales actually are no longer found in Eden. So that's important to preface too. This was a group of whales that were, as Cindy said, they were very, very common in this area for a long time, and then they basically disappeared. And so this is where, again, we're kind of looking back in time and saying, well, why did they disappear? As you said, are there any relations that dispersed? What happened, basically? What is going on here?
And as I was going through this, I was thinking about how much this can relate to what we're looking at with the southern resident killer whales here in the Pacific Northwest, about a population that could go extinct. And what does that mean? And how does that, work in the long time frame of killer whale ecology? So I think you'll see and hear a lot of, in case you don't see it, because you're probably just listening to this, but you'll hear, I think, a lot of similarities about, like, oh, that I could see that what's happening here is kind of mirrored in some ways, different, but some similar circumstances. So the introduction, we'll start with that, of course. And then I'll also preface too that this is all DNA. So
all genetic processing.
All genetic processes. So it's like they're going through all the nitty gritty of what liquid they used and when they froze it and then all this stuff. So we're going to whoosh right over the methods pretty much.
We're going to go very high level with what they did in the methods, just to not overwhelm you, because it was a little overwhelming for us as scientists who are not geneticists to read it. So
I'm like, sure.
Don't worry. We will spare you the nitty gritty details there.
Yeah. And you can certainly access the paper if you want to read through them, if you know more than we do about genetics. But so human-wildlife interactions, this idea of humans and I think particularly humans and wildlife working together collaboratively, are rare. They've been documented in killer whales, bottlenose dolphins, a similar idea of bottlenose dolphins in some places are known to corral the fish into the nets of the fishermen, and then they share the bounty, that kind of thing. Gray wolves and greater honey guides, which I don't even know what a greater honey guide is.
Shout out to a series of books that we used to read as kids, which were written in the 60s, where they talk about the local peoples working with honey guides to find honey. And they basically, they would lead, the animal would lead them to the honey, and then you had to leave them a share of the honey. And if you didn't, it was a problem.
Right. Well, there's rules, right? Cool. There's faux pas.
Yeah.
I'm not going to anyway, keep continuing.
I was very excited to read that. I'm like, oh my gosh, I know what this is.
Oh, I'm so glad, because I was like, honey good? And then I didn't even think about it. Actually, literally was like a guide to the honey.
Oh, that's so cool. Yeah, it's a bird. It's a bird. So the bird will locate these massive honey, you know, honeybees nests.
Yeah.
And you know, will bring people or other animals sometimes to the nest and basically like, hey, you need to get this down for me, but hey, because I led you to a food source, now I expect a part of this. Mm-hmm. And again, if you don't reciprocate, then the honey guide has been known to lead the person or animal to not so pleasant circumstances. Yeah. Where it's like, I'll like lead you to something else then, where it's like you know, hornet's nest or something like that to kind of punish you almost. Yeah. Wow. Very cool.
That is so, and that leads into more of like how much credit we give animals in their cognition and what they understand. Mm-hmm. You know,
if sorry, that's brief segue, everybody, but it was very exciting.
But that is so cool. But like, really, I mean, like, you don't think of a bird having revenge, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very cool. Wow.
Cool. Well, and then we'll talk about that a bit here too, about, you know, when this ended, why did that happen? You know? Mm-hmm. So, Eden, this relationship between these killer whales and the whalers have been documented through a wide range of historical sources, from written accounts to oral history. And it's been documented since 1844 to for almost a century. And again, we'll talk about it, but that's the small time frame. This has been going on a lot longer than since 1844. This is just when, you know, written documentation or more standardized recording was happening. And so every June the killer whales arrived, and they would herd a baleen whale into Tupelo Bay, or they would alert whalers to the presence of the whale by tail slapping and splashing in front of the whaling station. And this happened day or night, so I guess somebody's in the whaling station all the time.
I guess so. I mean, it makes sense given that this was a big, you know, big economy at the time.
Yeah.
That you, if there was a whale there, you would have to know about it right away, and you would want to take advantage of it right away.
Exactly. So then the whalers would get out in their 9-meter boats. They would row out, and following the killer whale to whatever baleen whale it was. And the two that they highlighted were humpback and southern right whales. But that's not, certainly not the restricted. I'm sure they took whatever baleen whales showed up, but those were the ones that they documented. So part of the killer whale group would help herd the baleen whale. Some would tear along the fins and the flukes and swim below and bite the lip. Others would breach on top of it to try to drown it. And then the whalers would finally harpoon the exhausted whale, following with a killing lance to pierce the vital organs. So they basically wore it down, as they do in nature as well, and then allowed the whalers to kill it. And Old Tom specifically was described to help the whaling efforts by seizing and pulling the harpoon line in his mouth to slow down the prey. And I thought that was interesting. Like, you guys aren't doing it fast enough. Here, let me help you.
Right. Or just like, hey, you know, this is getting away.
Right.
Let me help you out over there.
Yeah. You humans, you're so silly. And so they did look at the tooth wear on Old Tom, because they have his skeleton, as we'll talk about, in a museum, and showed that might be true, but the tooth wear could also be due to other feeding stressors or other things. So it's not 100%, you know, that's what happened, but it seems like that was likely that it could have occurred. So then the whalers then put a marker buoy on it, and they anchored it to prevent it drifting away. You don't want to lose your kill. And they have that out for about 24 to 48 hours. So this is like the grace period of like, okay, you guys, the killer whales, we helped you get this whale. Okay, now give us some time to get our benefit from it. So the killer whales would then eat the lips and the tongue. That's the only things that they would eat. And only after that would the whalers collect the carcass. So, you know, all these kind of social interactions have rules. Right. Just like going up to shaking somebody's hand, or, you know, other kind of rituals that we have in society, there's rules. So anchor it, let them eat the tongue and the lips, and then you can go out and collect the carcass and do it. So this became known as the law of the tongue, and that both the whales and the people adhered to. Right. It was a faux pas, like the honey guys. Right. Don't mess
right
with
exactly.
if all of a sudden you're like, oh, thanks for helping us, we take the whole whale, well, they're probably not going to help you again, or worse, you know. And so this was a mutualistic relationship, and it made for a very booming whale industry, right? It really helped that because they didn't, the whales brought you a whale. I mean, geez, it's pretty good. but it's interesting because it went from a sustenance, right? Before this was just for the indigenous peoples to feed their families and their, you know, their lives. And when, you know, European colonization and whatnot occurred, now this was a commodity. It was for money. And so, as with anything else, can very quickly end up not having any whales left. So, but I thought it was interesting that, you know, the fact that they only eat the tongue and the lips, that is very common in current killer whale ecology. When they kill a gray whale, for example, they'll generally just eat the tongue and probably the lips. It, for whatever reason, that's the most energy dense or whatever. They just like it. I don't know. And so, you know, it was like, well, was this the whaler saying, yes, you can have this part and then we'll take the rest? Like, this was this agreed to thing. Maybe it was just that the whalers didn't care about the lips and the tongue. So fine, take it. So there was no competition. But either way, either if they were actually would like those and gave it to them, or they didn't care about them, so they just let them take them. Either way, it was cooperative hunting, right? And so that's kind of the key exciting thing here, is that this is cooperation between two vastly different species working together.
Right. And I think one of the biggest things there is exactly what you said. It's the acknowledgement on the part of the humans that this part was prized by the whales and you needed to leave that for them. It wasn't something that just happened and nobody noticed it. You know, it was like, this was actually, they were aware of that. And then they respected that that was the whale's contribution.
And they gave it a name, you know, the law of the tongue. And so then that becomes rich, you know, ritualized in the society. Like, that is a rule that you follow. And if you don't follow, there are consequences. I'm sure there were consequences within the indigenous peoples, if some particular whaler in the community didn't follow that rule, right? You don't want to mess up a good relationship that you have with another society. You know, similar with people, you can have one person that messes up that relationship if they don't follow the rules.
Yeah.
So it becomes kind of ingrained. These indigenous stories, as described there, are not incorporated oftentimes into ecological history. And so this is what the authors of this paper wanted to do, wanted to make sure that that was part of this and gives you a more robust and a better understanding of what actually was going on. So they worked with Stephen Holmes and his wife, Char Ray Lara, in an effort to incorporate their people's oral history and to help decolonize the recorded history. Right. So that's, I think, the important part is that this is looking at history not through a colonization lens, but looking through everybody's perspectives to get the complete story. So the relationship with the killer whales there is thought to predate European colonization by millennia. Like, this has likely been going on a long time since before that happened. And that was the true start of the law of the tongue. Perhaps it only got that name more recently, but that was, you know, for as long as that's been going on, that's what's been happening, right? That rule. Commercial whaling in Eden started in 1828. And so remember, the first documentation of this was 1844. So, you know, there's a large gap between when we actually started, officially documenting things versus when they actually started. And I think that
only the commercial whaling too. So again, that's important to note. This is not the subsistence whaling that we talked about. This is literally when they started to whale to make money.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I think that's so important to remember, is that we're looking back at these things. Oh, it started on this date. Well, did it actually, or is that just started because that's when we started looking at it or recording it or whatever? There's a lot of things that happened before we did better documentation or writing, or, you know, lots of stuff in oral history that never got written down. So it's important to incorporate that. In 1828, this commercial whaling basically capitalized on this long-standing relationship and turned it from that
subsistence.
Thank you. Subsistence whaling to a profitable one. And then, of course, pushing that to the point where now there's no more whales. But indigenous whalers were actually large parts of the crews because of that. They wanted them for their skills because they knew the animals, right? And they knew how to work with the killer whales. Whereas I'm sure many of the commercial, European whalers didn't understand that relationship at all, right? They wouldn't be like, oh, this they're helping us right now. No, they probably think they're competition because they do eat baleen whales.
Right.
So there were 25 to 30 whales in three different pods from what they know. Again, there wasn't a lot of research going on back then. But the notable names were Hookie, Cooper, and Tom, of course. But the killer whale started to disappear towards 1920. So again, reaching that 100 year mark of this collaborative thing. There are a few hypotheses, and I don't think we'll ever really know exactly why, but one is depletion of prey, right? There just wasn't any more baleen whales to eat, so they either had to go somewhere else or die out. Perhaps there was a breach of law of the tongue. And there was some occasion where Tom fought with some whalers and lost some teeth. And now I can't remember exactly when they described that. They just say a breach of the law of the tongue in which Tom fought for a whale with the whalers, resulting in him losing teeth. So this is the one I was talking with Kat beforehand. I was like, I remember hearing a story about fighting with the whale, like the whalers weren't doing the right thing. And so there was a fight with Tom, and that was a big breach of contract, basically. And I think some people believe that that's what started the end, right? You broke that contract, and he's like, okay, sorry.
Right.
I'm doing it.
Right. So that's kind of an anecdotal story. We don't know if that occurred or not, but that has been shared by certain people that maybe that occurred.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that did how much it change the story of
the outcome,
what's going on here. We don't know, but it's so that again is, as Cass said, is anecdotal. The other possibilities are killing of a killer whale that stranded while hunting a minke whale. That would also be a breach of contract, right? Like, okay, that's not okay, guys. Movement of the Thawa people out of Tufil Bay. And by 1928, no baleen whales were processed, and most of the killer whales had left. So for whatever reason, and like everything else, it's probably more than one of these reasons, the killer whales were just gone. Now, whether they dispersed or they went extinct, that's basically the question that this paper was interested in looking at, right? What happened to these whales? Tom was the last killer whale there and was beach cast in 1930. And so that's when they took him, processed and rebuilt his skeleton, and he's in the museum now there, which is why they're able to do this study. And there's only been a few confirmed killer whale sightings in Eden since then. So now it's over 100 years basically since
they
the last one. They haven't come back. And, we have, there's like humpback whales here, right? They were here before, then they disappeared because of whaling. But it took them decades before they started coming back to this area. So it's interesting that they still haven't. And, why is that for the killer whales here? So that's what they're trying to find out is the genetic ancestry, what are the genes of old Tom and by proxy his pod. And how do they relate to contemporary whales around the world? And looking at that, then seeing what the evolution of and what happened to the to his pod and his relations. So methods, again, real short. The old Tom skeleton is in the Eden Killer Whale Museum. One thing to remember is that it has not been in a super sterile environment, right? So this is, and it's warm there, Australia.
Very, very warm.
Very warm. Heat, DNA degrades fairly quickly, outside of bones and teeth and stuff. They stay longer in there. But still, those conditions are important in how much DNA degradation you have or breakdown. that you have over time. So there's, so because of that, they used his skeleton, basically taking teeth in part of the jawbone and ground it down into powder. And then they used, which was the other whale that they used, Kat?
They used a whale from Denmark that, so again, a whale skeleton from Denmark that was a similar age, also a male.
It was a little bit older, though. Climate.
I think it was within, it was a little bit older, but it was around the same life stage, I think, is what they were kind of trying to get at.
Yeah, same. Yeah, and you said same sex and same life age. I think that whale skeleton is about 70 years old or something like that, but still, in the grand scheme of things, pretty
right,
close.
Right. So they use that as a control to look at the amounts of DNA present in each one, you know, to kind of compare and contrast.
Right. So they basically could say, like, yes, the DNA that we got from old Tom is correct and reasonable. And, you know, we did it for this other one. We could do it from this one. They were fairly similar. So therefore, we can rely on the information that we're getting from old Tom. That's basically why they did that.
Yeah.
And so they used ancient DNA techniques because this DNA is really old. It's over 100 years old. And as Kat was saying, a very different climate in, was it Denmark, you said?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So very cold there. And the museum that it's in is, the skeleton itself is in a much more, not necessarily totally sterile, but a more pristine
environment.
Environment. Yeah. So the DNA that they got from that whale was likely better, you know, less degraded than old Tom, just correct, because of those differences. but it won't bore you with the, or fascinate you, depending on your, what you want. The ancient DNA techniques that they use, but you can't just use normal everyday, like, I'm going to go DNA the plant that's outside right now. Ancient DNA, you have to take much greater consideration about because of the degradation and how fragile it is. So they use those specialized techniques to work with the material. They had lab that has positive pressure and nightly UV irradiation to maintain the sterile environment to make sure that the only DNA that was in there was old Tom's. And they use like full body suits, right? So very, not just like gloves and glasses, you know, this is like movie, like in a movie where you're going like aliens. And stuff.
Right. Full on like hazmat suit level.
Exactly. Just for this DNA. Not working with like viruses or anything crazy contagious like that. Just make sure that the DNA that you're looking at is only from old Tom or the other whale. So the techniques that they use also to work with, they were specifically for working with short DNA fragments because of that degradation that happens with ancient DNA. You're not going to get the full, long, beautiful DNA segments because it just degrades over time. So they have to use techniques specific for doing that. Basically, then they did a whole bunch of complicated genetic stuff, I think. And then basically they compared that to what they got from the Denmark whale. And then also looked at the DNA genomes that are already in GenBank. So if you don't know what GenBank is, it's basically this huge database that once you sequence a genome, you can put it in there and there's, you know, thousands upon thousands upon thousands of different species of genomes that are in GenBank. And so it's a great resource because once you get yours, you can then compare it to ones that have already been done. So you don't have to reinvent the wheel and be like, oh, I want to compare it to North Pacific whales. Well, let me go get a North Pacific whale tissue sample and a North Atlantic whale tissue sample. You can just go to GenBank if they've already done it and compare. Just super awesome. And then, of course, they consulted. I thought this was very important, too. They consulted with Indigenous peoples about the samples when it was appropriate, like when they were using samples from different places or whatnot. They made sure that they consulted with those people before working with it. And then they used bioinformatics to analyze the samples. And the end thing is that they used 490 different genomes to compare around the world the different populations of killer whales and how related old Tom was to those. So,
good summary.
Yep, that's it. That's all I'm doing. The rest of it's real detail.
Moving on.
Thank you. All right, so we will take a quick break and then we'll get back with the results in just a minute. Hello, listeners. This is Cindy, the research director at Pacific Mammal Research, and I wanted to take just a minute to thank you for listening and supporting our work. And I wanted to see maybe if you wanted to learn a little bit more about the background of what we do and what we see in the field and other kind of cool information that you can get by subscribing to the podcast for only $5 a month. You can get ad-free episodes as well as these mini episodes where we discuss the things we've seen in the field, the stuff we've gone to with workshops, and other little interesting tidbits of information for our subscribers only. This is a great way to help support PacMam, who we are a very small nonprofit, so every dollar helps us continue the work that we do and provide the information and the fun podcast that we have that hopefully you guys are enjoying. So if you can, think about it, subscribe to the podcast, and help support our work, and we hope you enjoy. All right, we're back. So the results are going to be pretty quick. Actually, the more of the story really is the introduction, talking about this cool behavior that occurs between the animals and humans. But they did, you know, again, as we already mentioned, Australia's hotter, and the UV exposure from sunlight coming to the museum likely degraded the DNA more than it did for the whale in Denmark. But they were still able to, with having that control, that Denmark whale, they could see that they got quite a bit of DNA, maybe not as much as they wanted, but enough that it was very reasonable to be able to do the work that they wanted to do. So they sequenced 11,464 base pairs of an expected 16,386 I put the wrong number. It's that's less than the number that I just said. So basically around 16,000 they were expecting to get, but they got
11,500.
So that's pretty good, especially for fairly degraded DNA from a skeleton that's just being in a hot museum.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when they looked at and compared, again, they compared across the entire world of different killer whale populations. And the most recent common ancestor was with Old Tom and the Australian and New Zealand killer whales. They used both mitochondrial and nuclear DNA. So the mitochondrial is from your mom, and the nuclear is just your general DNA. So they used both of those, and they both basically pointed to the same thing, which is, again, mm-hmm. another confirmation that what you're saying is what is true. They have these haplotypes, which are basically like, it's a good way to explain a haplotype. It's like certain groups will have a particular pattern.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. And so you can look like, oh, this population has this particular pattern in this particular area. And then if you look at that same area of the DNA of in the another genome, population, you'd have a different pattern.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good way to explain it.
Excellent. I knew something about genetics. And so they have all these different clades. Apparently clade 5 is the one that they look at, they fit into, but that's basically clustering by geography. So, which makes sense, right? More closer living in individuals will likely have more related DNA than ones that are far away. But this clade 5 is very wide ranging, and that it includes killer whales from different ocean basins, such as the Atlantic and the Indo-Pacific. So I thought that was interesting.
Right.
Like, it's not specifically geographically. And some are like this, it's only found in this particular spot at all. Mm-hmm. And then other ones are like, everybody's going to share some genes across large areas, barely. And some of that depends on the behavior of the animals, right? Mm-hmm. So the genome clusters that from Old Tom, the genome clustered with the genomes from killer whales, mostly in Scotland, Gabon, Gibraltar, and North Pacific. Even though that clade kind of went over into the Atlantic and Indo-Pacific, there's still kind of this Pacific area and that they were more related to.
Still very wide ranging, though. I mean, Scotland and Gibraltar to North Pacific, like that's pretty.
It's a wide swath.
That's a wide dispersal.
Right, and that's so interesting because, you know, some killer whales have really wide-ranging, I mean, maybe not specifically that wide-ranging, but wide-ranging enough that they're mixing with others that are wide-ranging. And so then you have, if they're mixing genes in those populations, then it becomes this very wide swath. Whereas other locations are like, nope, we're just going to stay right here together and not mix with anybody else. So, and that's what's important to understand, is to know, are these genetically different or genetically, you know, unique, like the southern resident killer whales, right? They are a endangered population because they are genetically distinct from, and socially distinct from, other killer whales, even that are close by. So we need to understand that and to do our best conservation. They are not related to contemporary populations in Australia or New Zealand, which basically means they died out.
Yeah.
Because if Old Tom had, and the other population had bred with other animals in this area, they should still be connected to, have similar
more closely related to them. Yeah.
Right. So interesting. And then they also decided to confirm whether he was a male or not. I mean, there was old pictures from there, and it's pretty distinct that he has the large, straight, giant dorsal fin of a male. They are sexually dimorphic in that way, but they wanted to confirm. And so you can look at basically the amount of X's, because female has two X's and males only have one X. So you can look and see that relationship. If it's a 1-to-2 or 1-to-1 relationship, you know, okay, it's a female or a male. It was confirmed, though, on the mapping program they used, there was some less certainty, but I think it's pretty set that he was a male. So that's basically the result. So basically, they're related to a lot of different whales and ancestrally in a wide swath of ocean, but there's no descendants, it seems, from the Old Tom or this population.
Yeah.
So the importance of the story is that he provided the first insight into the demographic and evolutionary history of this unique group of whales, because they are unique, just like the southern residents are. They have special, you know, their culture is different than even the northern residents, and of course, big killer whales and things like that, and other resident whales across the world. These were a specific pod that did this specific thing with these whalers. It wasn't just every whatever whale came in and did it, right? This was socially learned, theoretically, within these pods.
Yeah.
So the nuclear and mitochondrial genomes agreed on the ancestry. So again, that's kind of a double check to make sure. It would be interesting if your mitochondrial DNA showed one thing and your nuclear DNA showed another.
At that point, you might need to be like, okay, we can't use this information because it's too degraded, you know. Older. But that's, again, I appreciate that they did both of those, because as you said, especially working with ancient DNA samples, having that double check is really important to know if you're getting spurious data or if this is actually correct. So right. Again, like you said, the fact that they each backed one another up is a fairly good indication that what they're finding is accurate.
Right, exactly. So on the mom side, the common matrilineal ancestor to contemporary killer whales, it was in the North Atlantic and the North Pacific and New Zealand. So again, North Atlantic and North Pacific are very far apart.
As are the North Atlantic and the North Pacific from New Zealand. Which is in the southern hemisphere. So,
it's fine. It's just a lot of spreading going on, really, is what was happening ancestrally. Which makes sense, right? So you have some animals that are there, you're all related with that ancestor, but then this pod, you know, kind of separated itself and did its own thing over here, right? So it kind of makes some sense. The nuclear genome analysis showed the least genetic distance to New Zealand. So basically they were more related to New Zealand animals, which would make more sense, right? So they split off from that bigger group, hung out by New Zealand, and then the other New Zealand animals also hung out down there. So they are going to have the more closely related DNA over time compared to the ancestors that were from that larger population. Mm-hmm. So Tom likely descended from a common ancestor with the New Zealand branch and other related killer whale populations, hundreds to over 1,000 generations ago. But a subset of the ancestry remains shared by Tom and the closest related genomes included here. So again, it's like this, what they call it in the paper, founder families, right? So the killer whales appear to form from expansion of kin-based social groups or these founder families. So again, you have the larger whale population that share all this DNA, And then when you separate out, when some families go off and go, you know what, I really like this Eden place, it's super sweet, I'm going to hang out down here. And other whales didn't want to do that. Now, over generations, your genetic relations and your genes are going to be different than your ancestors of the groups that didn't follow you there. And so you're going to become more distinct and perhaps at some point so genetically distinct that you are a separate population or an ecotype, as we call them with killer whales, that you'll be different enough that from those ancestors. And so that's likely what happened here, is that that family group went down and then they kind of stayed within their family group there. And so their genetics just mixed within them rather than between other populations and no longer spreading those genes around.
Yeah.
They did note that this represents only a small proportion of the variation in Tom's genome. So there is other stuff going on. We can't figure it all out. They said if Tom was part of a small insular population, which is common in killer whales, so again, just this smaller group that popped down, then his recent genetic ancestors would come from a small pool of genealogical ancestors. So it's that founder family idea. Like, he's got the bigger ancestors, and then he has the most recent ancestors that are only a few rather than that larger population.
Yeah.
And so, again, because there is no... The lack of contemporary Australian genomes that are closely related to Tom suggests that they did not interbreed with other groups, which again is what you would find with the southern residents, right? Big killer whales come through all the time, but they do not mix at all. They run away from each other. And so they basically did not breed outside of their pods. And so therefore, when they died, they just died out and their genes did not get passed on outside to any of the future / contemporary now populations that are there. And so that they likely went to a local extinction, which is what we're worried about here with the southern resident killer whales, right? If this population goes, that will be a local extinction of a unique population, just like the Eden whales, which hopefully will not happen. But that's the correlate I was thinking about when we were reading the paper.
Yeah, no, it definitely makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, why did they die out? That's again a question that we'll probably never be able to answer, but it could be due to the loss of suitable environment. So maybe the environment just kind of degraded. It changes over time, just like things happen now. Even before great industrialization, habitats still change, right? Ocean currents do different things. Weather changes. There's lots of ecological and evolutionary time frame of things like that. So it could have just changed enough that they just couldn't make it anymore. Could be due to the motivation from the animal or human partner, right? So they, if somebody messed up that law of the tongue and they just decided to say bye-bye, and then either left and spread out so far. So it could be something that is not likely to happen, but they could be like, screw you guys, we're going somewhere else. And then they all spread out. So if they did that, and a couple in animals went to different populations, we probably wouldn't be able to detect their genetic input into those populations, because after a few generations, if only one or two animals went in there, it's not likely to be retained.
Right, it would be diluted to the point exactly. That you wouldn't detect it. Yeah,
exactly. So is that likely? Probably not, because killer whales are pretty tight. that could be a thing. Or that the compatible interspecies knowledge, it could have been the loss of the compatible interspecies knowledge of how to cooperate. So if certain individuals, again, we see this with the southern resident killer whales, the grandmother dies, that knowledge is lost, or at least some of it is lost about where to find food, how to find food best, how to, you know, do these things. She's taught those over generations, but some of that can be lost if she hasn't shared enough of it yet. So it's possible that some of the older animals died out or something, that and they didn't have time to teach the younger whales, or it changed because of how the whaling was, that they just didn't know how to cooperate anymore. Another possible. Honestly, I think the more likely story is that there were fewer whales and they probably just died out. Honestly.
Yeah. I mean, we do know that they moved from the area. So again, you know, as you said, whether it was basically, yeah, I mean, we're never going to know, but it was most likely a combination of all of these factors that just led to the eventual, you know, reduction and then just decline and disappearance of that particular population.
And just as we see with the southern residents, right, they're not here in the Salish Sea as much because there's no food, right? They don't have the salmon that they used to have historically. So they're going other places. So these animals also likely had to do that. They couldn't find a whale to bring to the whalers, regardless of whether the whalers did a faux pas or anything like that. Then they just don't do it. And they're going to have to go other places to find food. And so that leaving is really the point of when this all ended. And then what happened to the whales after that is just depends on if they spread out or they just died off because of when the whales or, you know.
Right. And it's also really important to note that in different ecotypes of killer whales and orcas around the world, these cultural traits are highly conserved. So again, we see that with the southern residents here. There are very specific strategies that they have learned over generations about how to successfully catch and consume salmon in this area. And again, just looking at this paper, these whales were interacting with humans for well over 100 years. I mean, just 100 years of written confirmation. And then however many hundreds or thousands of years before that with the indigenous peoples, this is a highly conserved behavior that has been taught culturally and passed on from generation to generation within that one population of whales. And if you now remove the baleen whales from that context, what are they going to do, you know, in a fairly rapid period of time that was removed, you know, and whaled out basically mm-hmm. by the commercial whaling?
Yeah, they don't have time to figure out a different strategy because the whales are gone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
exactly. So exactly.
That's a really good point because it may not even be the point of that the baleen whales are gone, or, you know, that they would find one, but then didn't bring it into the bay, but couldn't figure out how to fully kill it because they're so used to doing it with this way with the whalers, right? I don't know how often, what percentage of their diet was, if it was, you know, did they always bring every single baleen whale in to do this, or did they kill them on their own outside of that? That's unknown. But if enough of the behavior is in an amount of food that they get was through that particular cooperation, losing that may be enough that they couldn't survive.
Correct. Yeah. And just when you think about it over thousands of years, it's like, that's a very highly conserved strategy in your population. Like, to remove that is a pretty big deal.
Mm-hmm. Well, and again, it equates to the southern residents where people are like, well, why don't the southern residents just eat something else?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, but they've done this for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. So
yeah,
you can't just be like, oh, in the space of 20 years, go ahead and figure out how to do something completely different than you have been genetically and culturally and socially ingrained to do.
It's like, this is a really good analogy. I was having this conversation with someone else the other day, but it's effectively like asking us as westernized human beings who live in very modern cultures
mm-hmm.
To no longer purchase food from the grocery store. You're going to have to go forage and kill all your own food.
Yeah.
That's a really good analogy. Right. And I'm like, just go eat something else. The grocery stores don't exist anymore. You can't buy food anymore. In our highly westernized society, we don't know how to do that anymore. And so if you just threw them into the deep end and said, well, grocery stores are gone, you have to go forage and kill your own food in order to eat and subsist. A certain, like you said, a certain percentage would manage to do that. And you might subsist for a while, but you would not be very successful. And it would take a long time to then learn those strategies that, yes, we even had those strategies at one time as a species, but we've lost them. So it's, again, it's a good correlation just for us to wrap our brains around as human beings. It's not that simple for these animals.
Yeah, I think that's as good of an analogy as you can make for people to relate to. I mean, it truly is. Imagine, I mean, even if you could go out and forward, like, okay, I can go out and forward. Well, a lot of you are probably going to end up dying because you're eating something poisonous because you don't know it's poisonous because you've lost that knowledge that we used to have in history.
Yeah.
So that's why you should always make friends with people who know how to forage. Side note. But it's, you know, and it's good to get back in touch with that kind of thing, right? Of,
yeah.
Of we should not rely simply on the technology that we have, because if something happens, it's, you know, we have to think about that kind of stuff, in the grander scheme of life. But that's why it is so hard for these animals to just all of a sudden change, you know, and we may think like, oh, 20 or 30 years seems like a long time, but it's not when you're talking on an evolutionary time scale. It's a blink of an eye, and that's just not enough time over generations to learn new things.
Yeah.
So the last part of it, which I just really wanted to highlight, is that they are encouraging scientists to collaborate with the First Nation communities and acknowledge their role in shaping local ecosystems, and, you know, really taking and putting together with this, you know, our newer technology or whatever, the both sides, right, of all the sides of the history of an area, that if we don't have those, we don't understand, we will not understand the ecology as it stands, or as it was, or as it will be. It's really, really important to have those different voices and collaborate together to get that better understanding. Because only with that can we have the knowledge that we need to conserve it now into the future.
Yeah, 100%.
So that is the story of Old Tom. And you can, if you just search Old Tom, killer whale, there's lots of different accounts and stories. And if you want to delve deeper into his story and the Eden killer whales. But it really is just a fascinating story, and one that shows how we can work together and have a sustainable fishery, right? And you know, whaling, obviously we don't whale anymore, but that idea of having a sustainable way of doing things. And this was between two vastly different species, which was just, it's a very neat thing to see nature and humans working together and surviving and flourishing.
Yeah.
In that time.
And I think, aside from just the historical knowledge, I think the other really important thing that this paper demonstrated is that the Indigenous and First Nations peoples have a huge amount to teach us mm-hmm. as human beings, and just in their cultural approach to their relationship with the natural world, it's a lot more sustainable than a Western approach. And so I think that's the other really important thing that this paper highlighted is how synergistically this worked for a long time until it became about profit.
Yep.
And so just again, taking that away from this, the more we can learn from these cultures that have and have managed to maintain, you know, very successful interconnected relationships with nature and the natural world for centuries, the more we can learn from that, the better, honestly.
Mm-hmm. No, exactly. And there's been a few other papers recently that I've read with the same idea, where like this shows the sustainable, you know, fisheries and other things, and then, you know, industrialization and colonization, and then it just goes goes down. So it's that perspective, right, of how we're envisioning and seeing and seeing how we are in nature, or how we should say that we are in nature versus being dominant over it. I think that's one of the big differences themes. In perspective.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And if we can learn from our Indigenous colleagues about how we can see that better, and as you said, just viewing things that way will be more sustainable for the future.
Which
we need, because you know what, we kind of need Earth and all the animals.
So I love that this is becoming a more common theme in the literature too. I really appreciate that, and we will probably continue to do more podcasts that relate to this in various different ways, so stay tuned for that, because I think this is a really important conversation that I'm very grateful that the scientific community is now starting to have more consistently. So
So with that, we'll leave you again. Again, this was Ancestry Testing of Old Tom, a Killer Whale Central to Mutualistic Interactions with Human Whalers in the Journal of Heredity, published in October 2023. And so next time we'll have a marine mammal highlight, so keep an eye on the Instagram stories for your chance to choose. We're getting a little bit lower on animals now, but probably be some more dolphin species, because we have a few more of those than other species. So keep an eye on that. And don't forget, the holiday season is coming up. We have merch in our store. You can share, and all the proceeds from anything you buy in the merch store goes back to the research that we do and the educational things we do like this for you. So
quick plug, yeah. Really quick. If you are listening to this, we are recording this in November of 2023. So if you are listening to this in the next month or so, we do have our annual fundraiser happening until the end of the year. So again, we are a small nonprofit here in the Salish Sea. We rely on donations and small grants and support from our community. And you are part of that as our podcast community. So if you want to contribute in any way to supporting our research, supporting the podcast, providing opportunities for young scientists and budding scientists as well, definitely check out. We'll be sure to put a link to the annual fundraiser in the show notes for these episodes up until the end of the year. So if you would like to contribute to that, we would very much appreciate it.
That would be fantastic. That's a lot of our funding for the year comes from our annual fundraiser and those other grants and stuff that we get. So every bit helps. So if you feel the need, if you feel generous, please donate to the fundraiser. That would be fantastic. And with that, we will let you go, and we'll see you next time in Marine Mammal Highlight. Bye.
Bye.
This was brought to you by Pacific Mammal Research, a 501c3 nonprofit organization. Check out our website, www.pacmam.org, that's PACMAM, to learn more about us, our research, and the educational opportunities that we provide. Also, help us continue providing fun and educational content like this by donating today. Your help is how we can continue to do our work and share it with you. Thanks!